It is Monday, November 28th in Africa, and Sunday the 27th here in Washington, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin. Coming up, the Syrian government forces get closer to cracking rebel resistance in the northern city of Aleppo. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump confounds his critics with new claims of major fraud in the election he just won. We'll explain why the death of former Cuban dictator Fidel Castro prompted sharply different reactions among Cubans on the island and in the United States. And we'll tell you the story of a Maryland teenager whose passion for making jewelry made her a role model for young entrepreneurs. It's all ahead on International Edition. Thousands of Syrians have fled rebel-controlled parts of the northern Syrian city of Aleppo in recent days, as government troops and their allies captured several districts that had been in rebel hands for years. Word of the civilian exodus from the rebel stronghold of eastern Aleppo came on Sunday from residents of the city and from opposition activists. The gains by forces loyal to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad threatened to split rebel-held eastern areas of Aleppo in two. David Lesh is a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas. My colleague Victor Beatty asked him what he makes of the Syrian government's rapid military advances in Aleppo.
I think it certainly could be considered, as of now, something of a victory for the regime. Whether or not they'll be able to finish off the job, one wonders if they have the resources to go house to house and street to street, especially in Aleppo that's been virtually destroyed, at least in the eastern half. Do they have the support from pro-regime militias internally and externally that have come in from Iraq and Hezbollah and others in order to finish the job? I think that's what the rebels have been holding out for is even though they're trapped in the city, they're almost daring the regime to come in because the resources have been depleted. This is why they've adopted the bomb from afar and the barrel bombing and using other types of weapons just to avoid going from a house to house, a street to street. But they are committed, I think, to at least trying to do what they can to take most of Aleppo. And therefore, they can say that they control, almost all of the major cities in Syria, certainly the ones from Aleppo down through Hama, Homs, and Damascus, and, of course, on the coast with Latakia and Tartus. So in that case, the Syrian regime can say that, most of the population of Syria is under their control, and they can present themselves as the only alternative and therefore be in a catbird position if, when, any sort of negotiations toward a political settlement may take place.
Won't this be a Pyrrhic victory? I mean, the country in its entirety is shattered.
Yeah, it's many people say that if the war stopped today, it would take 25 years just to get back to the pre-war level in terms of economic production and GNP and so forth and so on. And it's going to take billions and billions and billions of dollars. And the thing is, it's going to have to come from countries that right now are, obviously set against Assad continuing in power, particularly in the region itself. Some of the rich Gulf Arab states like Saudi Arabia and Qatar, who have been so committed to ousting Assad, even if he is victorious, where is all the money going to come from in order to rebuild and provide the stability he says that his regime can do, and in fact is the only one that can provide it? And if he can't help rebuild Syria and offer some sort of victory dividend to those who have supported him, things could turn quite dangerous and nasty for him in the near future.
And that was David Lesh of Trinity University speaking to International Edition's Victor Beatty. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump has escalated his accusations of fraud in the election that he won earlier this month. In a tweet sent out on Sunday evening, Trump said, "Serious voter fraud in Virginia, New Hampshire, and California. So why isn't the media reporting on this? Serious bias, big problem." The Republican lost those three states to his Democratic rival Hillary Clinton, but won enough other states to get a majority of Electoral College votes that decide who gets the presidency. Stephen Dennis is a congressional reporter for Bloomberg based here in Washington. I asked him on the phone what's known about the information Trump is using to make his accusations of serious voter fraud.
You know, it's a mystery. He has not given any evidence that millions of people voted illegally. There have been some reports on some right-wing websites that illegal immigrants voted illegally, but there's no evidence of anything approaching that number that we've been given by the Trump campaign or that Trump has tweeted or linked to. It's just an assertion from him without evidence at this point.
Well, how concerned should Americans be that Trump is putting out information that we don't have access to, essentially? I mean, presumably he's getting his numbers from somewhere, and no one in the mainstream media seems to have that.
Well, it is really unprecedented, certainly in my lifetime, that a president-elect would tweet something like he tweeted a few hours ago, which is that he would have won the popular vote if you deduct the millions of people who voted illegally. This is sort of like we don't normally have winners of elections questioning the electoral system in such a fashion, and it's really striking. It comes a little over a day after the Clinton campaign announced that they would join. Well, not necessarily join a recount, but they would participate in the recount in Wisconsin and would also participate in recounts in Michigan and Pennsylvania if the Green Party candidate Jill Stein follows through on her efforts to file for recounts in all three of those states. But the Clinton campaign, when they made that announcement, said they didn't really expect the results to change. They don't expect Donald Trump to lose the election. They just want to ensure if there is going to be a recount that they would be there and participating. And that has provoked just a massive reaction from the Trump campaign, not just from Trump himself, but from his campaign manager, Kellyanne Conway, who ripped the Hillary Clinton campaign as sore losers for doing this, and it just looks like it's just getting uglier and uglier throughout this weekend, and it's probably now going to provoke reactions on the other side, because now that Trump has basically accused millions of people of voting illegally, that's a pretty serious charge, and you're going to hear reactions to that as well.
Is there a sense that maybe Donald Trump feels personally betrayed by Hillary, whom he says called him on election night to concede shortly before he made his speech, and that's why he has become so angry about Hillary participating in a recount that her people say she doesn't expect to change the result?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty valid interpretation, but he also appears to be rattled by the fact that he is losing by over 2 million votes in the popular vote, which of course does not count in our system. It's the Electoral College that votes in a few weeks. The electors will vote based on how their state voted, but he's right now losing by over 2 million votes nationally, and he's been doing a number of tweets trying to say, well, if only these people hadn't illegally voted, or if it was based on the popular vote, I would have campaigned differently, and it would have been easy to get the popular vote as well. And there's, you know, it's sort of like these are tweets of somebody who sort of seems insecure about having won. And it's very different from how George Bush handled it in 2000 when he also lost the popular vote and had a very narrow Electoral College victory. He just sort of acted as if, you know, he had won. I mean, there was a long recount in Florida, but after that, there was very little looking back on the actual election. It was looking forward to his agenda.
Okay, interesting comparison of the two Republican presidents who came in after losing the popular vote. Thank you very much to Stephen Dennis, Bloomberg Senate reporter, for speaking to International Edition.
Great to be with you.
Here are some of the top stories right now on voanews.com. Ex-French Prime Minister Fillon wins France's Conservative Party presidential primary. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu says Israel is committed to helping victims of recent fires. Pope Francis prays for Central American hurricane victims. Turkey accuses Islamic State militants of chemical attack against Turkish-backed rebels in northern Syria. And more Trump cabinet picks expected this week. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on voanews.com. This is International Edition. Friday's death of former Cuban President Fidel Castro has put U.S. policy toward Cuba back in the spotlight. President Barack Obama and his incoming successor Donald Trump have taken sharply different positions on how far the U.S. should go to improve relations with Cuba, a former Cold War foe. VOA's Amy Katz has this look at how Obama unfroze that U.S.-Cuban relationship and where Trump could take it next.
It was something that hadn't been seen in more than 50 years. In July of 2015, the American flag rose over the U.S. Embassy in Havana, marking the end of estrangement between the two countries. Months later, the first U.S. president to set foot on Cuban soil since the revolution that brought Fidel Castro to power in 1959.
I have come here to bury the last remnant of the Cold War in the Americas. I have come here to extend the hand of friendship to the Cuban people.
U.S. President Barack Obama went on to say that he knew there were still differences between the Cuban and American governments, especially on democracy and human rights, but the best way to address the differences is through engagement. And so began the loosening of restrictions on Cuba intended to create more economic opportunities. Experts believe it was important for the progression on the island to begin while Fidel Castro was still alive. But they acknowledge there is still more work to be done. Brian Fonseca of Florida International University spoke with VOA via Skype.
That said, I don't think that his death itself is going to have profound changes in terms of the political evolution in Cuba.
Critics believe there should have been promises from Cuba to improve its human rights record before any changes in U.S. policy were made. President-elect Donald Trump promised during his campaign that he would reverse Obama's executive orders regarding Cuba unless the Castro regime meets U.S. demands.
Those demands will include religious and political freedom for the Cuban people and the freeing of political prisoners.
Cuba observers don't expect much on the island to change in the wake of Fidel Castro's death. Cuban-American Congresswoman Ileana Ross Leitanen of Florida is among them.
Fidel Castro has really been out of the public scene for many years. The transition to Raul Castro has already taken place. So will there be real change in Cuba with Fidel's death? Well, at least it's a psychological burden that needed to be lifted.
Others, such as Florida International University's Fonseca, speaking to VOA on Skype, are more hopeful.
Could it sort of intensify or increase the speed at which, you know, change comes into Cuba? I mean, that's possible, because one thing that the death of Fidel does is create some space politically, at least in Cuba, for politicians to maybe think about taking the island in a different direction.
Over the past 2 years, U.S. policy on Cuba had shifted. With the election of a new president and Fidel Castro's death, it seems it may shift again. Amy Katz, VOA News, Washington.
Well, the death of Fidel Castro has triggered displays of mixed emotions in Cuba and in the United States. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman previously reported from our bureau in Miami, home to many Cuban Americans, and has also been to Cuba. Earlier, International Edition's Jim Stevenson asked Bowman for his take on the reaction to the passing of the former Cuban dictator.
Not surprisingly, there have been parades and tremendous festivities in South Florida, home to millions of Cuban exiles and their families and children. On the island of Cuba, it is, by all accounts, very somber and very quiet right now, as the nation is in a 9-day mourning period. Even people who defended Fidel Castro would admit that his record on human rights, on liberties, on freedoms left a great deal to be desired. Independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders was on television this morning. He's the only senator that does not mind the label socialist. And even he said that he had nothing good to say about Fidel Castro's human rights record. On the other hand, he did point out, which I think is fair, that under Fidel Castro's leadership, Cuba did make some advances in terms of health care, in terms of literacy, in terms of nutrition, in terms of education, and in terms of some of the basic necessities of life, if you will, but clearly at a tremendous cost.
The United States went through the Cuban Missile Crisis in the early 1960s, and that certainly cast a pall over relations for decades to come, as we basically blockaded the country and didn't have trade, didn't have formal diplomatic relations with the nation, and were essentially cut off from Cuba.
We were, although that all changed under President Barack Obama, who reopened relations, and there is now a functioning U.S. embassy in Havana and a functioning Cuban embassy here in Washington. The question is, what changes as a result of Fidel Castro's death? And I would argue very little. This is a man who had stepped aside and handed over the reins of power to his brother Raul, who remains sort of the spiritual leader of socialism on the island, and someone who was clearly beloved by a great many Cubans who remained on the island and remained loyal to the regime. But Raul Castro has shown no inclination to embrace any sort of liberalization on the economy or when it comes to political rights and basic freedoms. So I don't see any great immediate change there. I would argue that the greatest potential for change actually came in this country earlier this month, which is with the election of President-elect Donald Trump. Donald Trump came out with a very harsh statement on Fidel Castro's rule in Cuba. And the question is, once he is inaugurated in January, is he going to reverse course on what the Obama administration has done? And if so, if he wants to get tough with Cuba, what does that mean? Does that mean that he breaks relations all over again? Does that mean that he presses Cuba in some way for more concessions when it comes to dissidents and basic freedoms? And if so, how is that going to be received in Havana? I would argue that, yes, of course, we are talking about one of the most iconic leaders, for good or ill, that this hemisphere has ever produced. But his passing came at a time when he had already essentially handed the reins of power over. Maybe there will come some change, but I suspect that will come after the year 2018, which is when Raul Castro has pledged to step aside, if in fact he follows through on that commitment.
Well, Fidel Castro had been asked before he passed what would happen when he died, and he said, well, probably nothing, because there are many old revolutionaries ready to take control after me, and he was right. And the fact that he had time to actually transfer power to his brother in a rather orderly way, and there was this pretty large overlap between the two.
I would argue that there have been those who have been predicting the demise of Fidelismo, which was Fidel's particular brand of socialism, for decades and decades. And Fidel Castro outlived almost every one of those people who made those predictions.
That was VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman in conversation with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. It's time for a look at the social media reaction to this story. Our social media reporter, G. Abby Lee, is here with that. Hi, G.
Hi, Michael.
Well, Fidel Castro, who ruled Cuba with an iron fist for quite a long time, died on Friday. What is the buzz online with Fidel Castro's death?
Yeah, Twitter users are expressing their views on American politicians' reactions to his death, and former presidential contenders discussed his legacy during Sunday's morning shows.
Okay, well, let's hear what did some of the Republicans have to say.
Sure. Texas Senator Ted Cruz said on ABC News that he's thankful Castro is no longer with us. Now, some people said he is not celebrating someone's death, but other people said, you know what, he may not have been a great leader, but he's still a person, and it's a bit harsh to celebrate someone's death.
Right. How about Marco Rubio? I heard he was also weighing in.
Yeah, so it's interesting because he is a practicing Catholic, and Pope Francis actually sent condolences to the former dictator. But on CNN, Marco Rubio said he does not agree with Pope Francis and President Barack Obama on those reactions.
Right, and of course, Marco Rubio is a senator from Florida. What about the Democrats? What have they been saying on the talk shows?
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders appeared on ABC and said he does not praise Fidel Castro and that the Cuban economy is a disaster. His critics jumped in to say that his idea of democratic socialism will also be bad for the economy. His supporters, on the other hand, said there is a huge difference between democratic socialism and what happened in Cuba.
Well, it seems like President Obama is not the only world leader who's in the hot seat for offering condolences to Castro.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau shared a statement on Twitter in which he referred to the late president as a remarkable leader. Now, the top reply to the tweet was by Yosup Kim, who wrote, "I love you, but why are you praising a monster?" Another person wrote, "As a Canadian, I'm ashamed that you just warmly eulogized a murderous dictator instead of remembering his countless victims."
What else do you have trending online today?
Moving on to Abu Dhabi, where the Grand Prix is kicked off this weekend. People at the event are sharing photos of a commercial jet and a troop of military acrobatic jets flying into the sky to signal the start of the race.
Must have been quite a scene. Well, mm-hmm. Thank you very much, G. If you want to follow G on Twitter, her handle is at G Abby Lee, and my handle is at Michael_Lippin. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Traffic and parking tickets can cost a lot of money. Getting an attorney to fight them, well, not worth it until now, thanks to robots. Introducing Do Not Pay, one of the world's first robot attorneys.
Created this almost as a side project, but then 9 months later, millions of dollars worth of tickets were appealed, and over 180,000 tickets were successfully overturned.
Joshua Browder, founder of Do Not Pay, says the robot lawyer, more like a website chatbot, collects details, puts them in a legally sound appeal, which can be sent directly to the local authorities.
For example, it will ask you, was the parking bay too small, or was it hard to understand the signs?
Do Not Pay has expanded to addressing flight delays and property disputes, but Browder, a student at Stanford University, says someday perhaps he'll have the world's largest robot firm. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. We close our program now with a story about a U.S. teenager who hasn't just dreamed about running her own jewelry business. She's already doing it. Gabrielle Jordan, who lives in the state of Maryland, started that business at age 9, published a book at age 11, and began traveling across the country as an inspirational speaker when she was just 12. Jordan hopes her achievements can inspire other teenagers to pursue their dreams of entrepreneurship, as June So reports in this piece narrated by Carol Pearson.
Gabrielle Jordan is doing what she has a passion for, designing and creating necklaces, earrings, and bracelets. This 16-year-old entrepreneur founded a Maryland-based jewelry company called Jewels of Jordan.
I started Jewels of Jordan when I was 9 years old, but I have been doing jewelry since I was 7. I taught myself on YouTube because there was just something about it that really attracted me.
Gabrielle initially sold her creations to friends and family, but soon expanded the platform, selling her handcrafted pieces of gemstone, crystals, and cultured pearls at seminars, conferences, fashion shows, in boutiques, and online.
My target client is the modern, business owner, professional woman. One of the biggest things we say is that it's like we make the jewelry from the boardroom to the ballroom.
Jewelry was the launchpad for something Gabrielle loves even more, inspiring others. She took the lesson she learned from her business and wrote a book called The Making of a Young Entrepreneur.
When I was 11 years old, I decided to self-publish the book, so that I could still reach young people and still have this for them to read and hopefully be inspired to start businesses themselves.
And I know fear will come. And when it comes, I don't want you to ask yourself, what if I fail? I want you to ask yourself, what if I succeed?
The book helped her become a motivational speaker. She speaks at conferences, youth organizations, and schools across the country and abroad.
The goal is to really reach a wider demographic and to really bring my message even more around the world.
Self-discipline is important for this homeschooled entrepreneur.
I wake up at 5 a.m. so that I can get my schoolwork done, eat breakfast, and then go into making jewelry, preparing speeches, whatever it is that needs to be done for the rest of the day. And that's really how I have that balance. It was about that sacrifice and discipline in order to be able to be the CEO that I, you know, wanted to be.
Gabriel also believes in lending a helping hand and heart to others. At the end of the year, she donates a portion of her profits to her favorite charities.
Giving back is super important. I think for myself, it's just humbling to be able to see what other people have to go through and to see how blessed I am to be where I am in my life and to be able to have done the things that I'm doing and hopefully to do even more.
Gabriel looks forward to creating jewelry for stars and celebrities and writing another book by next year. For producer June So, I'm Carol Pearson. VOA News, Washington.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. If you want to find us on the web, you can go to voanews.com, click on the Programs tab at the top of the page, and then scroll down and click on the link to the International Edition program page. We also invite you to follow us on Facebook, where you can like our VOA Now page. Your director today was Tracy Carter, and the engineer was Charles Hall. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. I'm on Twitter, and you can follow me at Michael_Lippin. I'd love to hear from you. Hope you have a great week ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In many conflicts worldwide, human trafficking or modern slavery is often among the most tragic consequences. And despite persistent efforts to eradicate trafficking in persons, this abhorrent crime persists. According to the International Labor Organization, over 20 million people worldwide are victims of forced labor. On September 16th, U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations and December President of the Security Council, Samantha Power, stated that for groups like ISIL and Boko Haram, slavery has become one of their most versatile weapons of war, used to instill fear, to inflict suffering, to recruit followers, reward fighters, convert people of other faiths, reward combatants, and generate revenue. In Iraq and Syria, ISIL distributes women and girls to fighters as spoils of war, systematically rapes them, and sells them in markets like cattle. ISIL has even gone so far as to encourage the sexual assault of prepubescent girls and issue guidelines on how to treat the women and girls who have been enslaved. Boko Haram also exacts horrors upon those whom it has kidnapped and enslaved. On October 2nd, the group reportedly forced 4 girls and a boy to become suicide bombers in the Nigerian city of Maiduguri, where they self-detonated at a mosque during evening prayers. 15 people, including these kids, were killed, and more than 35 were injured. Witnesses estimated that the bombers were as young as 9 years old. Member states must commit to ending the conflicts that enable human traffickers to operate, as well as support trafficking victims. To address this in Iraq and Syria, where ISIL has enshrined systems of human trafficking and sexual violence, the U.S.-led 65-member coalition remains determined to destroy ISIL, stem the flow of foreign terrorist fighters, and restrict its funding streams used to fuel its reign of terror. The U.S. also continues to provide security and counterterrorism assistance to the governments of Chad, Nigeria, Niger, Cameroon, and Benin to aid their fight against Boko Haram. Human trafficking in conflict is a scourge that knows no borders. That's why U.N. member states must individually combat human trafficking and coordinate efforts now to put a stop to this human tragedy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
is